Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
Of course, host Anthony McCarthy Show and senior media fellow at our Center for Emerging Media that produces both of our programs. And Anthony joins me here every Monday evening to co-host this program or bring his astute observations about our society.
Thank you, my friend.
Before we jump into our conversation with Dr. Joseph Stiglitz, I want to remind you that support for WEAA is provided by the law offices of Sandra Martin Douglas, offering yesterday's work ethic in today's legal world through quality representation and sound legal advice in criminal, family, and personal injury legal matters. To schedule a consultation, 410-685-6181 or online at smdlawoffices.com. That's smdlawoffices.com. We, Anthony and I, are now joined by Dr. Joseph Stiglitz, who is, of course, a Nobel Prize-winning economist. He won the Nobel Prize in 2001. His books include Globalization and Its Discontents, the $3 trillion war, for which we talked to him about. Most recently, Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking World of the Economy. And he's former senior vice president and chief economist of the World Bank. And joins us, I'm not sure where he's joining us from, but he's joining us this evening, and we're glad to have him. Joseph Stiglitz, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
Always good to talk to you. And my co-host, Anthony McCarthy, is here as well. The number is here at 410-319-8888. Join us here at steinershow@gmail.com, or you can log on to our Facebook pages, Mark Steiner, Anthony W. McCarthy, and join the conversation there. I really am really even fascinated by the latest things you've been writing, and before I kind of walk through very specific questions, I want you to talk us through a bit this question of deficit spending. I mean, we're now, I mean, that has become the watchword on Capitol Hill and in most talk shows around America, that we have to cut deficits. That is the bogeyman we're facing. And you and other economists who are trying to be heard through that din are seeing almost the exact opposite. Explain to our listeners what you've been writing and talking about.
Well, there are a couple points. The first is that remind us that it was short-sightedness on the part of banks that got us into the mess, and that this deficit fetishism, as I call it, is equally short-sighted. If we spend money on investments, that like investments in infrastructure, technology, education, not only do we create jobs in the short run, expand the economy in the short run, but we get long-run returns. But when we expand the economy in the short run, we get more tax revenue. When we expand the economy in the long run, we get more tax revenue. And you can show that all it takes is about a 5 or 6% return on this investment, and the long-term national debt is actually lower. So if our focus should be on the long-term debt, not the debt deficit this year, and if you're concerned about the long-term debt, then it is really short-sighted to say we ought to cut back. And it also, of course, exacerbates all kinds of social problems. There's another way of putting it that I can maybe help explain, which is the every firm has a balance sheet. The balance sheet has two sides, assets and liabilities. When you increase the liabilities, you borrow. Whether you're better off or worse off depends on what you do with the money. And if you borrow money to buy a very productive piece of equipment, you're obviously better off. Every firm begins by debt. The same thing is true for the government, for the nation. If we borrow, that's an increase on one side of the balance sheet, our liabilities. Whether we're better or worse off depends on how we spend the money. And if we spend the money on an asset, we're better off, both in the balance sheet sense, but also, of course, in the growth sense. The lesson of all of this is we have to be careful of how we spend our money, and that should be obvious. Resources are scarce, and you don't want to throw money away. And that's why, for instance, I feel strongly that the way we bailed out the banks was an example of wasteful money because we gave money to the bank. We didn't get back what we should have gotten back from it, and we didn't put conditions on the banks to ensure that they would lend money on to stimulate the economy. So that's something where we had a bigger debt, and we didn't have much to show for it.
Dr. Stiglitz, this is Anthony McCarthy. I have to ask you a question because you just talked about something. And as we were preparing for the show, I read several other economists who talked about, I guess what I want to ask you is, why did it not work when President Obama and his economic team convinced a majority of Americans that it was a good idea at the time to bail out these banks because that was the best way to pass those dollars on to ordinary homeowners and workers and folks who needed these dollars. It made sense, but something went horribly wrong. What went wrong there?
Well, one way of putting it is, you know, when we passed a welfare bill for the poor people in the United States back in 1996, we said, okay, we're going to give you welfare, but in return, you have to either look for a job or go into a training program so that you're more able to get a job in the future. But we put conditions on the money. When we gave money to the banks, for a reason that I cannot fathom, we decided not to do that. The result of it was that the same misguided incentives that had led the banking system to get us into all this trouble were still there. We hadn't changed the incentives. We hadn't changed the constraints. And so they behaved in the same kind of, you might say, reckless, irresponsible way. So we gave them money, allegedly, to help recapitalize and so that they would start lending and so that that would rejuvenate our economy. What did they do with the money? They took the money and they paid it out in bonuses. They paid it out in dividends. They didn't recapitalize. They didn't lend. And so you might say we trusted the banks, and they broke our trust. Well, I never really trusted the banks because I believe in incentives. And they behaved exactly that in a way that was predictable.
We have, a caller calling in was asking a question about the banks. Let me go to him, and then I'll come back to other questions as we talk with Dr. Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize-winning economist at Columbia University. His most recent book is Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy, who joins Anthony McCarthy and I here this evening. Vince, you're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Stiglitz. Yeah, you're actually right on the topic I was interested in. You know, because they were, saying all this stuff, how, if Congress did not pass that, I mean, they stood up for a day and changed the 4-page bill to a 13-page bill or something. But what would have happened if Congress had stood firm and not agreed to this bailout? And also, I'd like to know, I mean, why don't you have Larry Summers' job?
I have that. I wrote that very question down almost. Joseph Stiglitz.
Okay. Let me answer the first question. I'm a little bit sympathetic to the view that had we not come in, there was a substantial risk of a financial meltdown and very serious problems. On the other hand, I think the way we did it, the way we bailed out the banks, was outrageous, and I would have put a lot more constraints on it. The good news was that, the 3-page bill had no congressional oversight. I had been chief economist of the World Bank, and I'd seen a lot of crises, and I seen what happens in these crises, which is the banks that cause the problem, the bankers that cause the problem, use the chaos as a way of stealing more money from the public. And I was afraid, this had all the symptoms of the same thing going on, and that's why I thought maybe they didn't want any judicial overview and congressional oversight. What was so remarkable is that even with the oversight, how we got so badly cheated. The Congressional Oversight Panel pointed out that as we gave the banks money, they gave us back preferred shares and warrants. They valued these pieces of paper that we got back, and we got back about 67 cents on the dollar, and some of the stuff we got back less than 50 cents on the dollar. The complaint that I have is that we didn't make sure that the money went to recapitalize the banks. We didn't make sure that the banks lent, and we got back much less for what we gave them than we should have. The final objection that I had to the way it was done was you look at some of the bailouts like the AIG, You know, it was originally we were talking about banks, but it was insurance companies and investment banks, other financial institutions. We went, you know, a whole variety of financial institutions got money. In the case of AIG, the insurance part that we should care about was adequately capitalized. That's why they had separate insurance regulators in every state. The money that went to AIG amounted eventually to close to $180 billion to one company. That money was a non-transparent bailout to the banks. But we'll never get the money back, much of that money back. You know, the largest single piece, $13 billion, went to Goldman Sachs.
Mm. So the question, the other part of his question was, how come you don't have Larry Summers' job? And well, I was actually going to ask you, just on a personal side, the times we've talked to them on the phone in interviews, is many of us were shocked that you were not named as part of the economic team, at least to lend some balance to the discussions that take place in the White House.
Well, you know, I think one of the strengths that the Clinton administration had was that we had a wide range of perspectives, all the way from Bob Reich, who was Secretary of Labor, to Bob Rubin, who was Secretary of Treasury. And I think that there are some big advantages of having that kind of wide range of perspectives. One of the things that also has concerned me is that when you have people who were so intimately involved in the deregulation movement that led to the crisis and are seen to be closely linked with the financial institutions, even when they give the right advice, give the right, you know, tell the president the right piece of advice, mm-hmm. It's not clear that there will be confidence on the part of others. You know, did they really do the best bargaining with the banks that they could have done? There's always going to be a suspicion. And that's why public policy is so difficult. And I think that concern is certainly surfaced in recent months.
I'd like to focus on a couple of things here, because I some of the things we've been writing about, and I know that as we have conversations with our congressional representatives, some from around, it's interesting to hear your thoughts on this, because these would be questions we can kind of pose, posit, and push. When we talk about, and you wrote about this in your most recent article called that Obama Must Resist the Deficit Fetish, it was in Politico. You can also see it on josephstiglitz.com and link to his website on our website, steinershow.org, and read what he's been writing, because we're going to be talking a great deal about these in the air and having wrestling with these issues when Dr. Stiglitz will not be our guest. So when we talk about the kind of spending that you wrote about that yields high returns, I mean, let's talk about what that spending really does and why it works and where we would put that money so the returns come in, because people fear greater spending because it's going to drive us further into debt. And I want you to be very specific with our listeners at the moment about what kind of spending, in your analysis, yields a higher return for the American people to get themselves back out of debt.
Well, let's go back a little bit to some of the things that have really made a difference for our society and for our economy. You think, you know, what was the most important innovation of the last part of the 20th century? If you ask about that, most people would say the Internet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who financed the Internet?
Yes.
Government did. After the government laid out the basic framework, private sector was invited to come in and help develop it. But without the government, it would not have existed. If you do any kind of economic calculation on that investment, it was huge. It was absolutely huge. Now, of course, any good investor knows that he's not going to hit the jackpot like that every time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And some of your investments don't pay off. We did a study when I was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors on the returns to government investments in technology, and the returns were really huge. The returns in public investment in technology were actually much higher than the private investments in technology, and those were much higher than lots of other investments. You know, the example of private investments in commercial, in residential real estate have been a disaster. So relative to, you might call it, the opportunity cost, the returns on these kinds of investment are really huge. So that's the kind of very, very high return. But there's another category that I think are very important, infrastructure. Had we done just a little bit of investment on levees in New Orleans, we would have saved tens and tens of billions of dollars. And that's an example of an investment that had we made it. And by the way, everybody knew that we needed that investment.
Mm-hmm.
It was listed as one of the things that was most high priority investments. We knew it. And had we made that investment, rather than giving, a tax cut, we would have, the return on that investment would have been in the hundreds of percent. So given the underinvestment in infrastructure, this is another very high return. And finally, to me, education is absolutely essential. The world's changing very rapidly, and if we don't have well-educated people to respond to these changes, we're not going to be able to compete. Now, at the very top, we do very well. Our best universities, the graduates of some of our best schools, can compete with those anywhere else in the world. But unfortunately, if you look at the averages, we don't look very good. And very disappointing. You know, there are now standardized tests that compare the U.S. performance with those of other countries, and we're not up there. And that means we won't be able to compete, be competitive in the global marketplace.
I wonder, you know, when we hear the arguments that Medicare, Medicaid, but especially Social Security, are going to drive us into greater debt and destroy this economy. We're not going to be able to pay for people's retirement, which already most private workers have lost their retirement. Government workers are losing their retirement now as we speak. So, and so the argument with deficit hawks is that we have to begin to cut these social programs if we're going to get out of deficit and have a federal budget that works. So I really want to hear kind of your response to that. And I mean, because clearly we know, I mean, do you agree or disagree that Social Security is in trouble in the long run?
Social Security is a long-run program, and that means we can't be sure. I mean, it sounds strange to say. The best forecast that I've seen suggests that if there's a problem, it's easily manageable. And when I say that, it's the following. Ascertain whether the 75 or 100-year forecast represents whether there's a serious problem entails making assumptions like what is the rate of growth of the labor force and of productivity. And the increase in the labor force depends on immigration. And some of the central forecasts that people who are pessimistic use assume that the level of immigration is going to be very severely curtailed. It's not going to grow with the growth of our economy. And if you just change that one assumption, the Social Security goes from being in deficit to being in imbalance or even in surplus. This is something that, as I say, is manageable. At the very worst, if we continue to have increases in health and longevity, an adjustment in the retirement age can bring it back into balance. Social Security is not really the big problem.
What is the big problem then?
I was going to make one more remark.
Go ahead.
Had we privatized Social Security, which was the recommendation of President Bush and many of the conservatives, our economy would have really been devastated. I mean, just think of what would have happened if all the savings have been put into the stock market, and the stock market crashed in the way that it did 2 years ago. Our retirees would be joining the soup kitchens. We would really had a major social problem on our hand. So I think most Americans are glad that we didn't follow the privatization route. But going back, the real problem is healthcare costs. And this is not a question of that can really be adequately addressed by looking at public programs. The one part of our healthcare system that actually works pretty well is Medicare. But you can't isolate one part of the healthcare system from the total. And that's why healthcare reform is so important. Healthcare reform has to embrace, more accessibility, because if we don't, those who don't have health insurance will impose costs on the rest of us. But it has to have some kinds of cost control, and that means, for instance, doing something about the drug companies and their the kind of deal that was done under President Bush that allowed for the drug companies to basically charge us whatever they want.
No, I know we only have a couple of minutes left here, but I know that your realm is economics, not politics. We literally have about 2 minutes left, but I'm curious, what really interests me is how the popular argument is the exact opposite of what you talk about. And I'm always interested in how we begin to generate the kind of discussion that makes what you're saying understandable and more the popular argument, because it's never heard. It's not what we listen to.
Yeah, it's a good, hard question. And one of the reasons I wrote the book Free Fall was to try to make some of these arguments more understandable. At some level, they're not very complex.
Right.
Everybody can understand that if we spend money for an investment, we could be better off. Unfortunately, there's a kind of schizophrenia. In the private sector, we realize that firms need to borrow in order to even to do anything. In the public sector, we forget that a lot of the spending ought to be, and in fact is, for investment as well, even if we don't keep our accounts in that same way. Part of the problem, of course, is that some of our public spending are for wars for military spending, in which there isn't an asset to show for what we're borrowing.
Joseph Stiglitz, I really enjoy having you on this program, and it helps us a great deal to hear your thoughts. I actually would love to have you back for a longer period to record an interview about your new book, Free Fall. We'd like to do that. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. I do appreciate the time.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel Prize-winning economist, professor at Columbia University. His book, Free Fall, his latest book, Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World Economy. And I will look forward to talking to him and Anthony McCarthy.
Very interesting. I was reading some of the reviews of Free Fall. It is really a popular viewpoint, but as you said, Mark, oftentimes Dr. Stiglitz's analysis is considered not in the mainstream.
So we'll try to bring it to the mainstream
even with this White House. It's interesting.
It is, so we'll have to bring it to the mainstream.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's what we do.
Thanks so much.
Great, Mark. Great show.
Monday once again.
Great being with you.
And the Mark Sanna Show is brought to you by Urbanite, Baltimore's free magazine of ideas and innovation. This month, Urbanite talks about race in Baltimore with stories about the quest for diversity, the history of segregation, why Baltimoreans will still lead separate lives. Urbanite is available at over 800 locations. Visit www.urbanitebaltimore.com for a list of drop locations. And thank you all for calling and writing in and making the show as invigorating as it was. The Mark Sanna Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producer is Justin Levy. After today, he won't be alone. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gabe Pinder, and Marianne Amos. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner, and he's Anthony McCarthy. Take care.